This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In the news this episode, Boeing finally executes a major leadership shakeup. Boom Supersonic flies the XB-1 demonstrator aircraft for the first time. The FBI is communicating with passengers who were aboard the Alaska Airlines 737 when the door plug blew out. The FAA issues a proposed AD for 737 MAX wiring. The agency also wants to increase oversight at Boeing. And then finally, the FAA issued a proposed rule concerning a misaligned vane in the PW1100G engine. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 792 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark. He's a business jet pilot, he's a journalist, and he's the publisher of Jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening from beautiful Chicago, the former headquarters of Boeing, and who knows where it's going to be next week.
That's right. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. He works at the American Helicopter Museum.
Hi, everyone. This is about all you're going to hear from me tonight because I'm boycotting the show because it's going to be all Boeing all the time. So I'll see you at the closing.
We'll try to sneak in a few other topics, but boy, it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year. And he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Great to be here with you all.
And just to round it out, we have our main man, Micah, with us.
It's wonderful to be here. And Rob, you know, you wondered where Boeing was going to go. This is why I cleaned out my back bedroom. They have a place.
Good idea.
All right, let's jump right into the news. We'll start off. This is breaking news. Micah, this just happened. I'm out camping. I'm out in the woods, and this was the first I'd heard of that. But this happened today, correct?
Yeah. You know, we had the show notes put together. Everything was set. We had the number one news story and everything. And then I changed this to a number one with a bullet because Boeing CEO stepped down. He actually did. Dave Calhoun is going to step down and get out of the way. Also, it turns out that a few other people are going to step down, but it seems that the person going in to replace Mr. Calhoun is still from within the company and might cause a problem.
But, of course, Calhoun's not actually leaving until the end of the year unless they find a replacement for him first, which when I heard this, I kind of went, ho-hum. I mean, so he's going to leave.
Well, there's some immediate changes. The head of Boeing Commercial Airplanes, Stan Deal, he's gone. He left immediately. Stephanie Pope, who is currently Boeing's COO, is going to replace Stan Deal. And another change, this is interesting, the current board chairman, Larry Kellner, he's not going to stand for re-election. There was an election to the board to be the new chairman. That was Steve Mollenkopf. He's an electrical engineer by training. That's good, I think. He's also the former chief executive of Qualcomm. And yes, the board will choose the next Boeing chief executive. So I don't know if there's more to come, but here's at least part of a shakeup amongst the leadership ranks at Boeing. Something we've been talking about, speculating about, maybe even hoping for quite some time.
This is what I think most people would describe as a good start. I mean, I think it's an important for a number of different reasons. You know, not the least is that it shows the world that Boeing is committed to making the kinds of changes that they need to be making. And it was kind of interesting. The union said it doesn't go far enough, that there are more changes that they feel are required at the top. But I, you know, certainly it's symbolic. It kind of shows the world that they're trying to make steps in the right direction. And it's, I think, will also have a real impact. It's good to have new blood to come in. And I think they're all sensitized as to what the issues are and what needs to be done. So I think this is a good start and bodes well for the future.
But, you know, that's exactly what I thought is sort of what you said, Max. Was it Shakespeare that said, first we kill all the lawyers? And that's, I'm not saying anything bad about lawyers, by the way. My best friend is an attorney. But I'm also concerned when I saw that, Stan Deal, who's the head of, airline aircraft, is stepping down and being replaced by Stephanie Pope, who's the current chief operating officer. I kind of felt, you know, more of the same. It was somebody from the outside that needed to step in. But Steve Mollenkopf sounds like it might be a good person to have an electrical engineer take on, the chairman of the board.
Pope has some, well, a different kind of background at Boeing. As the New York Times notes, that she's kind of risen rapidly in recent years, but she was promoted to her role as chief financial officer of commercial planes division to head Boeing Global Services, and that provides aftermarket support to customers. So a little bit of a finance background in there, but also stirred in with some aftermarket support, so some customer support issues. That sounds like a good combination. But, you know, we'll have to see if the behaviors change, if Boeing makes a concerted and serious effort to address the quality culture in their company. The name changes are good. And as you said, Max, it's a start. But what really counts is, what do they do? And everybody's going to be watching for that.
That's absolutely true. And that's why when I led off with ho-hum, I didn't mean that I didn't care about it at all. But I'm really more concerned about what their actions are going to be and how many other people that have any kind of engineering background are going to be joining Boeing's board. Because right now, while this is all happening and they're on the lookout for a new CEO, who's kind of running things if Kellner has already said, I'm leaving? I don't know when Boeing's board is voted back in again. But in the meantime, who's running the show and what's the plan? I mean, my God, they've got a to-do list that's about a mile long.
And the question becomes, are they doing this to raise the stock prices, or are they doing this to build airplanes again?
Or are they doing it really just to save the company? I mean, I think that if they didn't do these kinds of things, if they didn't do these things, the long-term outlook would be not that great. It would I think, put Airbus in the, you know, position of just scooping up market share like crazy. So, yeah, this is really essential.
Yeah, Rob, you mentioned a plan. You know, they needed to have a plan, and I think that's really key. You can't change a large corporation that quickly. So we'll probably, hopefully, we'll see some near-term actions, but it's the long-term plan, something that's going to take years, I think, to accomplish. That's what I want to see. You know, how are they going to do that?
Well, I think the workers are going to be looking to see, are they management's actions consistent with their words? You know, so for example, they may say, hey, safety is our number one priority. And if there's all kinds of expense cutting and, hey, we got to make the company profitable, people are going to go, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, they've got to follow through indeed on this.
All right. We have a press release from Boom Supersonic. And as you're probably aware, Boom's long-term goal is the supersonic airliner they refer to as the Overture. But in the meantime, they have a demonstrator, the XB-1. And Rob, I think we have some good news, a milestone reached.
Certainly a milestone. I mean, the Boom folks have been working on this project for about 10 years from the time the first idea was even raised. They have a scaled-down version of the XB-1 that flew the other day out of a beautiful old Mojave Regional Airport there in the middle of the desert, where the SR-71 first flew, where the X-1 flew and went supersonic about, a lifetime ago to many of us. So that airport's known for a lot of firsts, and they are hoping at Boom that this is the first of many flights of its demo, its technology demo, that will eventually lead to the actual Overture being built, because they do have, while I'm not that focused on orders, airplane orders, they do have about 120 or 130 of these full-scale Overtures that will carry 60 to 70 people, I believe, on order from a couple of the airlines. So it's a step in the right direction.
Now, the XB-1 is powered by three General Electric J85-15 engines. David, those engines power like the F-5 and the T-38, I think, and some other aircraft as well.
They're small.
Right. I think it was originally, that engine was originally designed for something else.
A UAV.
A UAV, that's right. That's right. So that's what they're using for the XB-1. It's easy. It's off the shelf. They can they have access to them.
And there's a lot of them.
It's a known entity. But for the Overture, yeah, you may recall that just in, 2 years ago, in December 2022, Boom announced that they were going to develop a new engine. They call it the Symphony engine. I think the reason was the three major engine OEMs none of them felt like stepping up completely to develop an engine just for Boom Supersonic. So Boom said that, we'll do our own. Now, they're working with others on this. Florida Turbine Technologies, that's the company that's doing the engine design. Also, GE Additive is part of this for their additive technology. And Standard Aero is a maintenance company working with Boom on this as well. So I think all particularly interested in seeing how the Symphony develops, because that's maybe the big unknown. I mean, while the XB-1 demonstrator is conducting these flights and proving the technologies and so forth, in the end, that technology has to come together with an engine for the Overture, for the larger Overture. So we'll be watching that. But it's exciting.
Sure. And I think I was going to say, I think also what is exciting about this is that the technology demonstrator, even with the off-the-shelf engines, is going to try to prove whether the inlets that have been designed for this airplane will actually reduce the airflow in such a way that what comes out the back isn't going to create, or what's in front and in back isn't going to create that sonic boom, which is the point long before they get to the Overture. So I think the next year or two with the XB-1 are going to be very interesting, very exciting, especially for the Boom folks.
Yep, absolutely. All right, back to, Alaska Airlines and the door plug blowout. Micah, when I saw this story about the FBI contacting some of the passengers that were on that flight, I don't know, I was kind of surprised at that.
Yeah, it really shocked me as well. But apparently the FBI has been in touch with all the passengers on Flight 1282 where the door blew out, saying that they may be a crime victim. And this is all based on part of the discussion that we had on the show in regarding to Boeing being brought up on charges and being given 3 years to improve by the DOJ. And if they didn't improve, then they were going to be investigated further. And while the FBI refuses to confirm whether or not they've actually made these notifications, the attorneys for these people have said yes. A number of their clients have gotten letters from the FBI saying, and I'm going to quote from the article, "As a victim specialist with the Seattle division of the FBI, I am contacting you because we have identified you as a possible victim of a crime." And the letter was sent to all the passengers on Alaska Flight 1282. This is really unique. And as I've said before, I think a little scary, because This can, again, cause problems for the whole NTSB investigation and could actually reduce the possibility of finding out what happened and to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't disagree more. I couldn't agree more, Micah, because here in the U.S., everything that has transpired over the decades is about safety, and there have been civil investigations that do not involve anything criminal, because once you get into the criminal side, that's when people really start defending themselves and they begin pointing fingers, and because they know they could be on the hook for a lot of money, potential jail time, and that completely changes the outlook for anything safety related in this country. And we've never had anything like that before in the U.S. There are other parts of the world where air traffic controllers, where pilots, mechanics have been found guilty of criminal negligence and paid a price for that. But again, we've always been focused on getting to the root cause of the problem and making certain it doesn't happen again. But I agree with you. This is really scary because I don't want to see a trend like this begin.
One of the really odd things to me, anyway, in this letter from the FBI is that it asks the recipients to contact an email address, Alaska Flight Victims, and I don't know what it is, at whatever .com or .gov. It doesn't say in this article we're looking at, but I think that's kind of strange. Micah found, and I found this particularly interesting. Micah went back. I think you got this, Micah. The actual Department of Justice press release from 2021, which is titled "Boeing Charged with 737 Max Fraud Conspiracy and Agrees to Pay Over $2.5 billion." And again, this is from the Department of Justice, and it makes really fascinating reading. I mean, I think we might have looked at this back then, but it was really fascinating to go back and take a look at it. And it talks about how Boeing has entered into this agreement with the Department of Justice to resolve this criminal charge. It says related to a conspiracy to defraud the FAA's aircraft evaluation group. And it goes on and talks about the crashes of Lion Air Flight 610 and the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302. How they expose fraudulent and deceptive conduct by employees. So this is kind of the crux of this issue that, you know, you guys have been talking about here, where, you know, Boeing was let off the hook, making certain promises to make some changes. And if the Department of Justice finds that they being Boeing, well, basically defaulted on the things they said they were going to do, that opens up this big, big can of worms for Boeing, if you're certain.
Could this relate to our first story as to why some of these people are stepping down, so that they're not still employed by Boeing if they are called to testify? I don't know. I'm just curious what you guys think.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, I suspect that the leadership changes at Boeing needed to happen, you know, regardless of whether there's this issue with the consent agreement.
Sure.
Maybe it makes it a little convenient too. I don't know. But
yeah, my guess though is that if there are any criminal charges brought against these folks from Boeing, the fact that they're no longer on the board or no longer employed by the company isn't really going to be a big issue, because they'll go after these people anyway. I think. I'm not a lawyer, but my guess is that just leaving the company doesn't avoid prosecution.
Yeah, I think so. Well, Rob, there's also more quality issues with the Boeing MAX jets. We see something here concerning wiring flaws.
Now, this one is related to, and this is another one that went back a couple of years that just seemed to surface here recently in terms of news about some chafing wires, possibly, that are buried in the wing root that operate some of the flight controls, in this case some spoilers. And spoilers are on the upper surface of the wing, and they could be used for roll control in these large aircraft, or also when the aircraft touches down. Those are some of the panels that people in the cabin see go up from the wings to try to spoil lift and slow the airplane down. And there were a couple of situations in which aircraft were airborne and suddenly the crew experienced uncommanded rolls, roll control inputs, as if someone had cranked the control wheel left or right, and they could not figure out why this was happening. Luckily, the crew in the one example they gave us in the story was really, I mean, they were Johnny on the spot. I think the story said that the first officer, who was the flying pilot at the moment, was really quick, popped off the autopilot, grabbed the control yoke, and rolled the airplane back level, and then everything was fine. But, of course, what they've got to do is get to the reason that this kind of behavior is occurring, and they think it might be because of some chafed wires in the, you know, God, what Boeing needs is another problem, another quality issue problem. But that is something they're reviewing. The Boeing spokesperson did not say much about it, other than that she didn't think it was a critical issue. But when they talked to my buddy John Cox over there, who's a retired U.S. air pilot, he said, no. Any airplane that exhibits an uncommanded flight control extension of any kind, pitch, roll, yaw, no, that's not good. And they should be getting on it immediately. But again, the stories are just a little bit vague about how quickly they're going to get on this.
But Rob, how could the chafing wires in the galley cause a controlled problem? If the flight attendants are heating up something in the chafing dishes, then how would that create a problem that would put a plane into a roll? I mean, I'm not a pilot, but
are you saying that they asked, because they were heating up things in the chafing dish, they asked for the problem? Is that what you're trying to communicate with me?
I can't figure it out. The chafing dishes, chafing wires, it just seems, I don't know.
I do believe that this man has been without power for 2 days because of all the bad weather up there in Maine. And I think he's gotten a little punchy, but I might be wrong.
No punchier than normal anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, with all this going on, I mean, it's a legitimate question to ask, where's the FAA oversight been in this? And Max T, it looks like that's going to change at least a little bit.
Yeah, certainly we know that the FAA has been taking a very active role with Boeing. They just announced on Friday that they are going to be doing the same with United. And their United's Vice President of Corporate Safety, Sasha Johnson, sent out a memo to the staff that basically said, due to the number of safety-related events in recent weeks, we have rightfully caused us to pause and evaluate whether there's anything we can and should do differently. Now, that makes it sound like that was their decision. I suspect it was really driven by the FAA. She continues, over the next few weeks, we'll begin to see more of an FAA presence in our operation as they begin to review some of our work processes, manuals, and facilities. And then she says, we welcome their engagement and are open to hear from them about what they find and their perspective on things we may need to change to make us even safer. Now, there are a number of reports that say, and this, by the way, is not confirmed, but there are multiple sources saying the same thing. But this has not been officially confirmed, that the FAA has halted all new deliveries of aircraft to United. In other words, they can't put any new aircraft on the line. They can't establish any new routes. They can't issue any more approvals of line check pilots. They cannot issue any new type ratings, which essentially freezes their training. You know, folks who are looking to to upgrade are not going to be able to do that, and so that says that they're concerned not only about the maintenance side of things, but they're really concerned about the flight operations as well, and the flying side, the pilot side of things. Now, when I look at the long list of things that has happened over the last couple of weeks with United, it looks to me like all of those items except for one are maintenance-related items. The only one that looks like there was kind of falls under the flying side was the Flight 2477 that overran the runway and taxiway slightly because they appear to have landed long and fast at Houston. And so I would expect that they're going to spend a lot of their efforts on the maintenance side, just looking at the processes, things like making sure that maintenance tech has the required documentation out each time that they're doing work, making sure that all the correct reviews and signatures and things like that have happened. But it says that they're really a little concerned about the flying side as well, probably because the overrun at Houston it really appears from the data to be fairly egregious. It looks, if you believe what the ADS-B data says, it looks like the pilot did not follow the standard operating procedures. And I'm sure that got the FAA's attention. That's probably part of why they're looking at that side of the house as well.
You know, oversight is, I think it's maybe not well understood by the general public. Right? People see these things going on and they say, well, you know, why isn't the FAA, why isn't the regulator watching all this? Well, part of the issue is that the FAA's only got a limited amount of funding and a limited number of employees, and they can't be everywhere all the time watching everybody. You know, you'd need 100,000 FAA employees just to do the oversight. And, of course, they don't have that, and they don't have the funding for that. So I think typically what happens is the FAA or whoever the regulator is looks for almost self-regulation. They look for systems in place at the airframers, at the component manufacturers, you know, all the people involved in this, all the companies involved in this. They look for quality systems that are self-designed to catch problems and to catch issues and to deal with them correctly and appropriately. So oftentimes the FAA is, I don't know if certifying is technically the right term, but I'll use it anyway, is certifying a quality system and expects it to operate so that the manufacturer is doing the right things. I don't know where that's come unraveled. Is it, we talk about Boeing and, and quality problems there and the quality culture there that's lacking. But why wasn't that caught? Why wasn't the quality system deficiencies identified long ago and dealt with? To me, that's kind of the real question, but I don't know if we'll ever
hear that. Well, this whole system is based on trust. It always has been for decades and decades that the FAA had a working agreement with the aircraft manufacturers that said, look, we know we can't be everywhere looking over everybody's shoulder when they, plug a rivet or, make some changes to a particular system. So here are the standards we expect. And the manufacturers have always said, you can count on us to do that. And by and large, they have. I mean, going back to Boeing for a minute, I mean, they've been in business for 100 years. Look at the B-52. I mean, the B-52 is probably older than any of us are pretty, well, maybe some of us. but again, they built incredible airplanes. Look at the 747 and many of the other ones, the 727. I mean, they have a rich history of building machines that met the standards, and there were not these quality problems. But I don't think it's a coincidence that 20 years ago when McDonnell Douglas and Boeing merged and this focus moved away from quality to production numbers and get them out the door, get as many out the door as quickly as you can, because that is what we're going to use to keep our shareholders happy because they'll see these great dividends coming in. Again, that kind of thing has changed, and that is what I think has led Boeing to the problem they have right now, which is that people don't trust them anymore. They don't, you know, people on the outside think this is an incredibly silly system. How could you possibly trust the builder to get it right? Well, because both parties, the FAA and the manufacturer, have some skin in the game. It's no benefit to the FAA to have a company building airplanes that are not safe, and it's no it, Boeing is already feeling it in terms of what their reputation has taken a tremendous hit in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's not over yet. I mean, they have a long way to go before they're going to be back anywhere where people will trust them. But I don't know if any of you saw that, but last week the FAA administrator Michael Whitaker was interviewed by Lester Holt on the TV, on NBC, I should say, and Whitaker said some interesting things that, you know, he visited the factory floor at Boeing. Now, I don't know if he's in D.C., obviously. Maybe he went to the South Carolina plant. I don't know. He didn't indicate which factory he was at. But he said, you know, I expected to see remnants of a safety culture that were so obvious remnants of a safety culture. And I didn't see that.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, from a PR standpoint, you'd have thought that Boeing knew he was coming. You'd have thought they would have told everybody, guys, get your act together. The administrator is coming. We've got to look perfect. And they didn't. And that did not make the FAA administrator feel very warm and fuzzy at all. And again, you know, it's not as if Boeing is just learning about these issues. They've known about this since the first MAX went in Indonesia 6 years ago, was it?
Yep.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, and the deferred prosecution agreement that we spoke about before was saying, Boeing, we'll let you guys off if you guarantee us you're going to meet these standards, these safety standards coming up. And Boeing isn't doing it. And so we keep seeing that. Now, do I want to see this turn into a criminal investigation? Absolutely not. But Boeing needs to get its act together and realize that the world is serious about, you know, wanting to fly on an airplane that they trust. And so, again, that whole word trust has just kind of, it seems like it's not worth what it used to be over there at Boeing HQ.
Let me bring it back to United for just 1 second. You've seen arguments in the press where people are saying, well, is there really just, is this normal business as usual at United, but we're just hearing about it more, or is there a spike in these kinds of events and they're being reported more? So it just seems like, you know, things are worse suddenly at United. And I guess the point I'd like to make is it almost doesn't matter which it is. This is, I think, an appropriate moment for the FAA to come in and say, well, there might be a problem. We're not saying that there is, but since there might be a problem, we're going to come in and take a look. And I think that's their role, and I think that they're correct in doing it. I think that what they're looking to do is, are we preventing all the little tiny problems so that we prevent a big one further on down the road? I think in the past, perhaps, you know, pre-Boeing issues, the FAA was probably just a little more willing to, as you said, Rob, trust that the airlines were doing what they said they were going to be doing. And, you know, this is just the opportunity to check in and see, all right, is there a problem or not? And if there's not, great. But there's always an opportunity to improve any process. So I have no doubt, even if the number of total incidents has not gone up, United is going to learn some things about how they can improve. And that's good for all of us.
And that actually goes along with an editorial piece that was in the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday, on March 20th, by Holman Jenkins, that talked about understanding the Boeing mess and how it says a lot of it has to do with opportunity and the media pulling it all together, and that chronology became causation. And you know, it may or may not, but I think what you were saying, Max, is that it's a good thing that we're looking into it. That's the whole purpose of having the NTSB and the FAA, to look at these things to see if there is definitely an upsurge, or are we just more aware of what's happening?
And I think there are always plenty of opportunities to look into these kinds of things. And it's not just Boeing. It's not just United. We see in Flight Global that there has been a problem with the Pratt & Whitney PW1100G engine, and the FAA is responding to this issue. It's a misaligned. It's called a misaligned vane issue, which caused an engine failure in 2022, and this was the low pressure compressor first stage integrally bladed rotor in an Airbus A320neo. That engine failed, resulting in an engine shutdown. The FAA has issued a proposed rule that would require airlines to replace that rotor. Pratt & Whitney says that this is a known issue. It affected a certain number. They call it a limited number of engines, which, by the way, is not related to that powdered metal, that contaminated powder metal issue that was in the press a few months ago, I guess. But concerning this other compressor issue, the hardware has been deployed to the fleet over the past 2 years. They had done that through previously released service bulletins. The issue is, again, this misaligned inlet guide vane, which sits ahead of the low-pressure compressor, and the disruption to the intended airflow was enough to cause vibration or something in the compressor to take effect, which caused the whole rotor to fail.
Well, Max, this is exactly what you want to see when you have a failure in a problem. Pratt & Whitney did the right thing. They looked at it. They figured out what the problem was. They came up with a fix and a solution, and they took responsibility for it, and they're working on it to clear it all up, as opposed to another company, and I don't even want to go into it anymore, that seems to just be letting it go on and on and on, doesn't seem to care.
It's partly a culture thing. I mean, as many of you listening know, I had a long career at Pratt & Whitney. But, you know, when I was there, when a problem arose, the culture was not, you know, oh, my gosh, you know, what are we going to do, you know, try to cover it up or try to minimize it or anything. The executives were always interested in stepping right up and saying, okay, you know, this may be really bad. Maybe it's not so bad. Maybe it's in between. But regardless, stepping up and saying, okay, we have to fix this. There was never any question of, well, you know, how much is it going to cost and how long is it going to take and, you know, what's going to be involved. It was a culture that just stuck to the notion that if the customer is getting something that's not 100% reliable and working as it should, then we figure out why and we fix it.
And yeah, that's part of a good safety culture, right?
Yeah.
You're not looking to place blame, because if you do, everybody kind of scurries and hides and doesn't admit mistakes and things don't get fixed. So yeah, it has to be non-punitive. People have to believe that it's okay for them to make mistakes, because everybody does make mistakes. So yeah, I mean, you definitely were in a good safety culture.
I was always kind of interested in these. This is back to the article, the PW1100G. These integrally bladed rotors, which is always something that's hard for me to say. It's a design that's unique relative to historical designs. Historically, whether you've got the compressor or the turbine, you've got a set of airfoils of a certain size, basically in a ring attached to a disc or a hub that rotates. And each of these airfoils fits into that disc in a slot. They call it a Christmas tree slot because it kind of looks like it's a Christmas tree. It's that kind of a design. And so you would have a disc with all of these blades in a ring and have a number of stages for the compressor or for the turbine as well. But in an intricately bladed rotor, it's all one piece. They're not separate airfoils that are attached to the disc. They can be cast that way. Sometimes they're machined that way from a solid piece of metal. Sometimes they can be additively manufactured that way. So when you have one airfoil failure, you have to replace the whole thing. But these things are tending to be lighter than the old designs. They tend to offer better aerodynamic efficiency as well, and that's why you have them. Sometimes they're called blisks, which is a lot easier for me to say than integrally bladed rotor. But blisk comes from taking blade and disc and putting them into one word. That's where you may hear the term blisk. Or if you really want to impress your friends over cocktails who are talking about these engines, just introduce the term blisk, and they'll think you really know what you're talking about.
And then you can bathe in the blisk of knowing.
That's right. Okay. Any other news items or things of that sort that you guys have?
The one I was going to mention was the article in Asterix magazine, Why You've Never Been in a Plane Crash. It talks about Annex 13 and how the NTSB came up with the blameless postmortem.
So tell us more about that.
So this was sent to me by my good friend and Krepluck brother, Eric the Mapmaker. He sent me this article that came from Asterisk Mag by a woman named Kyra Dempsey, who is a private pilot. And she wrote this wonderful kind of explanation called Why You've Never Been in a Plane Crash. And it talks about the whole NTSB investigation and the system that we use that was developed back in 1951, something called Annex 13. It talks about how aircraft accident investigations should be done as what's known as a blameless postmortem, that you're not looking to blame the person that's responsible for it. You're looking for a way to keep the accident from happening again and come up with a solution. And I really loved reading this because it explains everything that we have been talking about when we have spoken of what's happening with the DOJ and the FBI and all these other things, and how it could actually change the whole concept of what the NTSB is trying to do to fix the issues that are taking place with Boeing right now. So I read it. It was really interesting. It's very, very simple to read, but it explains it in a good way. And I would recommend it. We'll put it in the show notes.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see. Let's start with Max Trescott. What have you got going on these days?
Well, it's funny that Micah should mention Annex 13 because I've been studying Annex 13. I am in Los Angeles for the second of 2 weeks attending courses at USC's engineering department where they've got an aviation program. And one of the courses I took in December, we talked in great detail about Annex 13, which is part of one of the number of different documents that ICAO has on different topics. This one just happens to be on aircraft investigations. But last week was a course on human factors. Talked a lot about different airline programs that they use, and as well as safety culture, which we've talked about a little bit here. This week, I'm in the helicopter aircraft investigation course, which is great. We just had the first day of that. Some folks who know so much about helicopters, and of course, everybody in the room is connected with helicopters, either flies them or maintains them, and they work for a number of different companies and agencies from around the world, so it's really fascinating. Over the weekend, I got an opportunity to go to a place that we've talked about here in the past that I'd never been to before, and that is the In-N-Out Burger at LAX, right next to the touchdown zone of the North Complex of LA. And what great fun. So if anybody wants to go out on Twitter, just look for at Max Truscott on Twitter, or you can go to my Facebook page. I posted a couple of videos there, and it's every bit as good as you've heard. You've got, for example, my favorite video was an A380, which was streaking almost directly overhead. And so it's quite fun and exhilarating to be there and to do that. We also had winds gusting to 33 knots, and it was a cold, rainy day. So it was kind of interesting. It was actually cold to be there in LA you know, watching these airplanes fly overhead. And then finally, I just mentioned episode 320, which I managed to get out last week for Aviation News Talk, in which we talked about how to make better landings using data. And a lot of new avionics glass cockpits will collect data, and we talked all about how to analyze that to improve your landings.
You see, Max, that really does sound just like you're in total bliss, eating a double-double while watching the airplanes land at LAX. I can't imagine anything better.
It's true. I haven't been to in and out in a long time, so it was fun to have a hamburger animal style.
Animal style. Very good.
Isn't it amazing, though, that for all the – considering all the publicity that In-N-Out Burger gets, that we don't have In-N-Out Burgers anywhere else in the country? I don't think, do we?
They're in a lot of states.
I think they just opened one in Colorado, and I think the first one ever to close, was it Idaho or Montana? One closed down, the first one that they ever closed. I can't remember where it was.
They've been in Nevada for a number of years. But you're right, maybe it's the West Coast.
All right. Some of you may have noticed that our website was down for a few days. Apologize for that. We had some very odd behavior going on. Took some sort of corrective actions that I'm reasonably confident will keep the problem from recurring, but I'm not entirely positive I didn't break something else. So if you notice any strange things going on with the website, I know most of you don't go to the website because you download the podcast episode in your podcast app. But a number of people do go and listen from the website, or certainly go to the website to see our show notes and to find links to the topics that we talk about. So when you're doing that, just let us know if you see anything strange or if you have any access problems of any sort. Just send us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. But hopefully that issue is fixed, but we just kind of want to keep an eye on it for now. All right. And Micah, exciting things going on in Maine, I think.
Oh, it's been a crazy week. First, I had to clean out my whole back office bedroom and finally found the dead chipmunk who had wedged his head under the radiator cover. And boy, what a lot of fun it was to get him out of there. But my place doesn't smell anymore, and poor Hal has been buried successfully. But then on Saturday night, you know, it was like my lucky night. Fortunately, I was stepping out of the shower and not stepping into it when the power went out. And there was a big ice storm. Again, I had just to put one foot out of the shower, and the power went out. It was out for 36 hours for me, and other people are still without power here in Maine. It got cold. It was kind of bizarre not having electricity for that long. You forget how much you really depend on it. But it's back. God came back this morning after Saturday night, spent the night with some friends last night, and everything's good for me, and I hope everybody else is getting theirs back too. And the highlight of the week, of course, was that this week we released episode 67 of the Journey is Reward podcast. Me and Brian put it together, and it's the story of Brian taking a flight on Southwest Airlines up to Sacramento to visit Lodi. And no, not Lodi, New Jersey, Lodi, California. And it's a fun episode.
Great.
Here in Chicago, we've been blessed for a long time at our airport, Chicago Executive, to have a real old timer around the airport, even older than me. My friend Howard Levinson was a B-24 aircraft commander during Second World War, and he had just turned 100, and I saw him at a party about a month and a half ago, and I don't know, we got talking about something, and he said, "Hey, how old are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to be 75. He said, "Oh, God." He said, you're just a friggin' kid. Yeah, wait till you get some really, really great experience under your belt, kid. And but anyway, he was a good guy, and we lost him last night at 100. And so we all wanted to say adios, blue skies, and we're going to miss you, my friend. Again, so that's Howard Levinson, late of Chicago Executive Airport.
All right, we have a short listener recording. This is really great. I'm really enjoying this. Tom has he's been a listener for quite a while. He calls himself an inactive private pilot. He volunteers at Air Venture on the South 40. He's former U.S. Air Force. He was an avionics instrument system technician on several different aircraft. But he was listening recently to episode 790, the item with the 787 that suddenly, unexpectedly dropped in mid-flight. And that news item caused him to remember something, a similar episode from his past. And so he sent us the story written out in an email. And we said, you know, instead of one of us reading that story, why don't you record it for us? And he did. And it's not too long, but it's fun to get stories that are recorded from you all listening. If you have an experience, something, a little story to tell, you know, we'd love to hear it. So let's listen to this.
Hello, airplane geeks. The episode 790 news item, 787 drops in mid-flight, pulled up the memory of a somewhat similar episode in my past. In the late 70s, I was an Air Force instrument technician returning to Travis Air Force Base, California, from a two-week deployment to Kadena Air Base, Okinawa, aboard a C-141A Starlifter. The cargo bay was configured with a comfort pallet, 96 rear-facing airline-style seats, which are six to a row and far less comfortable than the current economy sardine seating, and a baggage pallet in the rear. I was in my mid-20s and still able to fall asleep in such seating. Somewhere over the eastern Pacific, I was roused by a loadmaster. You the instrument man?
Yeah.
They want you on the flight deck. Great, I thought. Now what? Okay, I mumbled as I stumbled forward, waking up. The flight deck is a four-step ladder up from the cargo deck. Up I go. The flight engineer says, we have an FDR in op light. Okay, I'll take a look. The FDR is the flight data recorder, an early version of the infamous black box. As this was a mid-60s manufactured aircraft, the technology was mid to late 50s. The recording media is razor blade thin steel ribbon, about 4 to 5 inches wide, rolling in a tractor feed cassette magazine at a very slow rate, while the data is scribed onto it by several needles, leaving a permanent scratched record. The FDR records parameters like attitude, altitude, airspeed, heading, temperature, G-load, and a few others that time has removed from my memory. The instrument shop regularly R&Rs, removes and replaces, and sends in the media, but it lasts many flight hours. Meanwhile, I go back down to the cargo deck, turn left, and take two steps to open the latrine door. The left and forward latrine walls are a heavy fabric held in place by hook and loop tape fasteners. Taking down the fabric cover reveals an avionics bay with a great deal of mechanical and avionics equipment, including the FDR. The FDR is an orange, crash-hardened, rack-mounted device with quick-connect, self-sealing, pitot and static rubber hoses on the front, covering the magazine access door. These hoses must be disconnected to open the door. Sitting on the toilet, mind you, it was closed, I remove the hoses and open the door by unscrewing a captive thumb screw, lifting the thick door to clear the gates and swinging it down. Releasing and removing the magazine reveals a snarl of torn, razor-sharp media. The fix is to tear off the mangled ends, clear the scraps, and rethread the media so it can continue recording. But I need an important supply. Good old tape to reattach the fresh torn end of the media on the take-up spool. back to the flight deck to seat masking tape. Of course, the flight engineer has a roll in his bag. Taping and rethreading the media, I reinstall the magazine and close the door. Now the point of the story. I snapped on the pedal line, grabbed the static line, and began to connect it. And holy crap, the plane noses down hard. I'm sitting on the can, holding nothing but a flimsy half-inch rubber hose, hearing the screams and shouts from aft. At once, I thought I had caused the significant descent. In the momentary venting of the static system to the cabin altitude during the attempted connection, everyone without their seatbelt on, and everything else not secured, became a separate flying object. The couple of guys sleeping on top of the baggage pallet in the rear got the worst of it. A very rude awakening, and maybe a broken finger or something, but fortunately nothing too serious. I pensively finished the connection, replaced the wall, and went up on the flight deck to return the tape and ensure that the FDR and op caution light had extinguished, signifying proper operation. No one on the flight deck said anything about the dive, so I returned to my seat as we continued home to Travis, my seatbelt on. As I played the event through, I realized that I had not caused what must have been a turbulence event. Had we been cruising with altitude hold engaged, and by my momentarily venting the static system to cabin pressure, the autopilot would have commanded a climb to return from cabin altitude up to cruising altitude, not a dive. Thanks for listening. Tom Lau, airplane geek, inactive private pilot, air venture volunteer in the South 40, and a U.S. Air Force E-6 avionics instrument system tech from 1970 to 1981 on F-4s, C-5s, and C-141s.
I thought he switched the hoses. It's like, oh no, the static got connected to the pedo and vice versa.
And whenever you do something that causes a really violent reaction, you quick undo what you did and put them back together.
Exactly.
But Mr. Lowe, thank you for sharing that story with us. I really enjoyed it. I have to say, I enjoyed listening to him tell us the story as opposed to one of us just reading the text. So maybe we could make that a regular thing if people would like to do it.
That would be great. It was so great hearing that story. And what I was really afraid of, as he's talking about it, it makes me think of my days. And Max T, you've probably had this experience too. You know, when you're working in radio back with reel to reel tape and you're editing with a razor blade. And, you know, even with the razor blade, you're not touching the tape, but I've got scars on my fingers from it. And I was afraid that that whole razor sharp ribbon was just going to cut him right up. I mean, I was like, oh God.
Boy, I've cut a lot of audio tape in my days. Yeah. Happy we're not doing that anymore.
For sure.
All right, Micah, I see you've got a shout out here. This is relating to the A-10.
Yeah, you know, it's time to say goodbye to them. The Air Force is finally retiring them. I know it's one of our favorite aircraft by all of us, and there's no need to argue whether it's time for them to go or not. They're going, and what's important is that this is the final year. It's the farewell tour of the A-10 demonstration team. And we have a link to all the shows that they're doing this summer. Actually, started last month. But this is the final tour. And if you want to see A-10s flying together, and that demo team is just amazing, try to catch it this summer because you'll never see it again.
Haven't we heard this before, though, that the A-10s were on their way out?
Well, they are on their way out, but more importantly, the demo team is – the A-10s will be flying for quite a few more years. The demo team, however, will not be flying after 2024.
Okay.
I did see the demo team, the A-10 demo team, once some years ago. I don't remember which air show.
Weren't they at Pittsburgh when we were there? I can't remember.
It seems like it was after that. But I don't know. But I do recall being really impressed and really enjoying that demo team. I mean, they're all different. My favorite always remains the F-22 demo team. But the F-35 demo team is great as well. They're all kind of different. And with the A-10, I remember that it's not like an F-22, right? You don't have the velocity or the maneuverability. You just don't. It's a different kind of aircraft designed for different kinds of purposes. But it was really spectacular and fun to watch as well. So any of you, if you haven't seen the A-10 demo team and check out the list of their appearances this year, if you have an opportunity, it's worth it. And especially because this is the last time. Check it out.
I don't think it's an airplane. It's actually a large gun with wings on it, isn't it?
It is. A really fast gun. I love those videos of the Gatling gun firing. It just, the sound that it makes, well, it's nothing like an automatic weapon that you might have heard, you know, the sound of it. This thing, it fires so rapidly.
It's like a buzz.
It is like a buzz.
I first time I heard it, I was amazed. I didn't know what it was, but it sounded pretty cool, even though it's a very dangerous item.
Sure, sure. I think it's, what is it? Is it 1,000 or 2,000 rounds per minute, I think? It's just amazing.
Yeah, you won't see it fired by the demo team, by the way. Just
that's true.
Yeah. And just for folks that are listening, this coming weekend, you can see them at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. And then the following weekend, April the 6th, they'll be in Bullhead City, Arizona.
Ah, I got to check that list. All right, on to some listener mail. Patrick Higgins wrote in. He sent us a link to a program on PBS on Nova. This is Great Electric Airplane Race Preview. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. This is a preview for season 48, if you can believe it, episode 7. It says, can new emission-free electric planes replace our polluting airliners and revolutionize personal transportation in our cities? Nova takes a ride in some quiet, energy-efficient prototypes that are vying for success as electric flight takes off. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Thanks, Patrick, for sending that in. All right. Unless you have anything else, guys, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Another short one. We have a guest scheduled for next week. So we're looking forward to that. You can find us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com, assuming it's still up. And we have a permanent shortcut link that redirects right to the show notes for each episode. And that's just airplanegeeks.com/ then the episode number. So this is episode 792. So if sometime in the future when that episode is scrolled down and you want to get right to it, airplanegeeks.com/792. Our email is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a Slack listener team, also a Discord server. And if you'd like to participate in either of those, then just simply write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll tell you how to get in. All right. Rob Mark, anything closing?
Nothing that I already haven't gone on and on and on about tonight. So I'm going to give everybody a break and say, just find me around anything that has Jetwine in the title.
All right. And David Vanderhoof. David is a man of his word. I've always known David to be a man of his word. And if you recall his opening statement, well, he kept his word.
Well, yeah, I did talk about I'm tired of talking Boeing. I think next week we should have a Boeing-free episode.
I like it.
What?
I like it. Let's do it.
Well, why don't you make sure you talk to the Boeing people about that and tell them to stop giving us all so much great ammunition.
Fodder for the cannon.
This is worse than the tanker stories, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's definitely worse than the tanker stories.
Weren't those Boeing takers also?
Yes, they were. So you can find me at the American Helicopter Museum. And you can also find me on the various things if you can spell Vanderhoof.
Okay. And Max Prescott, tell us about where we can find you or get a hold of you.
The usual place, head on out to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
And Micah, our main man.
I'm still on Twitter, hanging out there, whatever you want to call it, and it's at MaineFly, Maine, the state of Maine with an E. That's the important part to remember. Fly is pretty easy. And then you can find me with Brian Coleman, our former associate producer on the Journey is a Reward podcast.
Excellent. Ian, speaking of podcasts, there's a new podcast that's just started recently.
Oh, yeah.
With, let's see, John Ostrower.
Cranky Concierge, Brett Snyder.
And the third?
Brian Summers.
And let's see if I can remember. Oh, the, it's the called, name of the pod. Go ahead, Micah.
It's called The Air Show, and they have two episodes out. And the first one is just an introduction, and the second one, they start to get into it already. And, well, you know, I'm not familiar with Brian, but it's great to hear Brett and John go at it. They're wonderful.
It is, right.
Does this qualify as another one of our spinoffs?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't go that far. But I don't know. Well, you could ask him. All right. I'm Max Flight. You can find out where I hang out online. Just visit 30,000feet.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Nighty night.
See you real soon.
Thanks for listening.